Welcome to Jump Podcast. I'm your host, Traveling Jackie, and I'm here to explore travel, adventure, and lifestyle in ways meant to motivate you to move and experience the world outside your comfort zone and to do big, courageous things with your one life. Let this show be a source of advice and inspiration, and remember that in the end, it's you who takes the leap. This episode is supported by Osprey, my go-to luggage brand for everything since 2015, and by Oboz Footwear, my feet's ride-or-die adventure shoe brand. So stay tuned for more about my recent favorites from both of them. And of course, we're supported by Jump Adventures and our own collection of epic adventure itineraries to Patagonia and beyond. Let us send you on your dream adventure. You can find out more and browse trips at jumpadventures.com. All right, we have a brand new subject to dig into today that we've actually never talked about before on this show, and that is veterinary work overseas. So here to shed some light on this super niche way to travel is my guest today, my friend Chelsea Anderson, who's Dr. Chelsea Anderson to you guys out there. She is a veterinarian, and she's been to more countries than I have, and she has hauled suitcases full of vet supplies to some of those countries. So I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you, Chelsea. Welcome to the show. I'm really happy to finally get to do this.
I know.
It's been a long time coming, I think. Your story is so fascinating to me, and I feel like you kind of just do it. Like behind the scenes, it's like a passion for you. It's what you do, but I feel like you don't, it could be such a big story, and like it's just your little Instagram that you share, and like it's just this thing that you just fly under the radar, and I love that about you, and I'm glad that you're willing to actually say some of these things out loud, because I feel like you'd be super content to just like stay under the radar and just do your thing, and I respect that a lot. But thanks for showing up.
Of course.
So before we get into your cool vet stories, I know that doesn't just come out of nowhere, and so maybe we can start with a little bit about who you are and what your background is that eventually led you to become a veterinarian. And I know that you have a massive passion for travel. So I'm curious, like, which one came first and what is your background in travel?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start with professionally. I was one of the people that kind of always knew I wanted to be a veterinarian, and I just never wavered from that. And very lucky to have that just so early on, because it really did drive, you know, my education moving forward and, you know, decisions that I had made leading up to that. But I did my undergrad at the University of Connecticut, where I grew up. Purposely, I got a really big scholarship to go there, and I knew I wanted to go to vet school, which is expensive. So that was part of my decision to go. And it was a great program. And it gave me a lot of opportunity to explore different areas within veterinary medicine before I had even applied to vet school. And it also afforded me my first chance to go abroad for really like my first big trip overseas that wasn't to see my family in Europe. So that was really awesome. And that sparked things for me.
Wait, okay. I did not know that your first... Okay, so I know you have family in Belgium. So of course, going to visit family, that's cool. But I did not know that your first foray into international travel was actually with your school, like with your program.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, we had gone to Belgium like once or twice a year growing up. And then, you know, did our typical like occasional family vacations to the Caribbean or Mexico growing up in New England. But yeah, my first like big trip, it was, you know, I was going by myself, not with my family, although I was with classmates and our professor, but I had taken a South African wildlife ecology course because I minored in wildlife conservation. And I mean, selfishly, when I signed up for the class, it had been, you know, something that students talked about, but I was like, I want to do this solely because I get the chance to go to South Africa at the end. And I mean, it really just was such a pivotal moment. And I loved everything about that class, like probably my favorite class I ever took in college. But yeah, at the end, we went to South Africa for 6 weeks.
Oh my gosh, that's not a short amount of time.
No, it was kind of like a summer course. Like we did the book work during the semester, and then we went into the field and did a lot of field work. And I mean, it was just a dream trip, like nothing I knew. Africa, especially Southern Africa, is so foreign and so unique. And we were living at the camp and basically going on game drives every day to study the animals and then having kind of lectures and talks at the end of the day or in the mornings before. And, you know, our head guide, Lee Guttridge, he's written several books on South African animals, like guidebooks, and he's one of the head trackers down there. And so we actually got tracking certified at the end. So we had to like test out and like walk down a road and identify the tracks and like be able to tell what they were and, you know, what direction they were moving. And wow. I mean, I still think about that trip all the time. Like, it was for sure a life-changing trip for me.
Wow. I can imagine. I cannot believe we haven't talked about this.
Yeah.
Although I'm so glad that like this conversation gets to happen on the podcast, because I didn't even know that was like a thing you could do. You know, I love that your school included that as a program. Like, what a great idea.
It was such a cool undergrad program to go through, like not just for that, but I mean, the University of Connecticut started as one of the original ag colleges in the U.S. And so it was very animal science forward, which for me was awesome. But the wildlife conservation program there is great. And so, yeah, I minored in wildlife conservation. I majored in animal science and pathophysiology to try to get into vet school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, wow. I'm not an overachiever or anything. So the double major minor was a lot of work.
Yeah, but it seemed to put you on the right track. And especially, was this program at the end of your undergrad or?
It was my junior year. So it was 2009, the summer of 2009 going into 2010. And then I graduated in 2010.
Okay. And then you go to vet school.
Yeah. So I applied to vet school. Thankfully, I got in and I decided to go to Cornell in upstate New York. For a couple of reasons, it's an excellent veterinary school. Both of my grandfathers went to Cornell, one for engineering and one for medicine. And so it felt a little legacy, even though it wasn't really directly legacy. And they also gave me the most financial assistance. So it seems wild, but Cornell was actually my least expensive option for veterinary school.
Good for
it was
you.
Expensive, but it was mm-hmm. the least expensive.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to have any international experiences in that part of your schooling?
Yeah, I did. I try to maximize my travel as much as possible, as you know. I had a couple different opportunities, and like most students, if they wanted to do this program called Expanding Horizons, that Cornell Veterinary School does, it's a funded program for students to propose a research project somewhere in the world. And then in theory, you get a little bit of grant money to go do that. So as soon as I found out about that program, I was like, I'm going to apply for this. And so my second summer of vet school, I applied and I got accepted. And I spent the summer in Uganda.
Wait, so you had to propose the program though, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you figure out what to do?
There were a couple different options. I mean, if you had connections within the veterinary school, this is like one of the nice things about kind of ivory tower tertiary academia is that you have people doing cool stuff all over the college. So basically you just had to like find somebody who was willing to help you write a proposal or who had an idea or who was maybe already working in a country somewhere and come up with your own project for it and then propose it. And then you didn't need to get accepted for it.
That sounds really huge. That sounds like a really big deal. What was your project?
So I went three times.
Wait, you just said you weren't an overachiever. I don't know.
I was being sarcastic. Yeah. Who would have thought? So my first summer I went to Uganda. My project was studying basically to see how much Ehrlichia, which is a tick-borne disease, was present in the stray dog populations down there, because it's just something that's never really been looked at. And so we did a lot of blood tests on dogs. I worked directly with a veterinarian in Entebbe in Uganda, and I lived with him for the whole summer in his spare room. We had no showers, so I was taking bucket baths for the whole summer. It was great. I mean, we would drive around and go. He did private like work as well. There are a lot of expats in that community and also locals that have dogs or, you know, have a collar on a dog that wanders around the streets.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, we... basically drove all around Uganda, taking blood samples from dogs. And usually as a result, like part of the reciprocation was that we would be rabies vaccinating them. So there was incentive to try and get, you know, people to let us draw blood on their dogs. Because sometimes there's a little bit of a cultural barrier for things like that. They think you're taking something without giving something back. And that's a thread that I've found throughout my international travel. Like a lot of, you just have to make sure that this is something that's working for everybody, right? Yeah. Like the last thing I want to do is show up in a place and then take and then leave. So usually there's some sort of incentive to, you know, get people to agree to work with you.
Yeah. Well, so you were able to be vaccinated against rabies as you were doing your studies. This was one of your projects though, right?
That was my first project.
Three times. So what were the other ones?
So my second year in 2012, I went to Indonesia and I lived on Java for the whole summer. And my project was actually doing soil sampling, but the link to public health and veterinary medicine is we were looking for anthrax, which we found. And the reason for that is that the Javan rhinoceros is one of the most endangered rhinoceros species on the planet. There are like 35. And so they were dying, and we know that cows and water buffalo were also dying kind of in ways that anthrax presents, like suddenly dying in a field, that maybe there's been recent rain and the soil has been kind of, you know, unearthed a little bit or settled in a different way. And so we had asked the government whether they thought that anthrax could be a possibility. And I say we because I worked with a professor who was already sort of involved in this. And they claimed that there wasn't any anthrax present. And so we were just looking. And so we would go to all these villages around Ujungkulon National Park and going back to like making sure that everybody's on the same page with what's happening. That was probably one of the biggest barriers to actually be able to do what we wanted to do, just from, again, a cultural standpoint of permission. So we had to arrange a village meeting at each village that we went to. We had to meet with the chief of the village. Then we also needed paperwork done at the Ministry of Agriculture. And then we had to basically sit and drink coffee or tea for hours. And it's mostly just a trust standpoint. It's not even, you know, talking the logistics the whole time. It's just hanging out. And then, you know, once you reach that point, then it might be okay for you to continue with your project. In most cases, it was. And like we were working with locals, a local veterinarian, two local veterinarians, and also like kind of an intermediate person who spoke a lot more of the local dialects. There was a lot of sitting and waiting, but also kind of one of the best ways to experience doing that. We're usually outside.
Sure. I hear about that, though, in a lot. We do things a certain way in this country, but the rest of the world doesn't really work like this. And so I hear that a lot in a lot of projects like this that you need. I mean, and it's so good. It's such a good approach to gain the respect and the trust of the locals. You have to do that. You have to.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no other way to do it in your case.
Yeah. So. I mean, I go back to people using the term island time where like things just run a little bit slower. Like, I think that is definitely something that I've experienced pretty much everywhere where I've done work. Like, the U.S. is so driven, so go, 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 like, to a fault sometimes. But there, it's like, all right, let's dial it back a little bit. Like, who are you? What are you like? Now we can move on. What are you trying to do? But it was a lot of steps to get to the ultimate final project.
Wow. So what were you able to accomplish there?
So we sampled over 30 different villages, different soil sites. We then had to like analyze the soil. There's a test that you do to test for spores and to look for spores. And basically we were then presenting that information back to the Ministry of Agriculture to say like, hey, we found things that are suspicious for anthrax. And when I left for the summer, those were going off to like the national lab to get confirmed. And so a lot of it wasn't just permission of like being able to do this thing. There was a lot of public health education that was happening during those meetings too of, hey, like if you have upper respiratory signs and you've been near a dead cow, like you should be careful because we think that this might be one of the things that's causing them to die. And again, the professor I was working with, he does exotic, like wildlife exotics. So the rhinoceros was really his pinpoint there. But I mean, it's all related, right? Like we use the term One Health in veterinary medicine a lot, which is starting to become a little bit more accepted. But like there's so much that's linked. And, you know, we're just like one ecosystem that's living on the planet. So
sure.
Yeah.
Do you know if your work there was able to help save rhinos, or like, do you know what the end result was?
Yes and no. I mean, it is easy to kind of lose the continuation of that. But my understanding is that there was going to be a big public health movement to basically make people aware that cows were probably dying from anthrax and how to handle those bodies because they're valuable. And for a lot of those villages, like one cow could be an entire family's worth, or, you know, feed them for the whole year. So, you know, approaching that. But we were it's hard to extract information from the government that they don't want to give you. Like, they didn't think that anthrax was there in the first place. And then we gave them this information. So I don't have proof, but that was my understanding.
Wow. What a great, like, worthy effort, though, you know, and such a good cause. I mean, did you imagine that that was going to be the kind of work that you'd be doing in as a veterinarian? Like, here you sign up thinking you're going to get to, like, work with people's dogs and cats, probably. Like, <Yeah. laughs> there you go to Java, and that's so cool.
I mean, I think that work is amazing, and I almost wish that I could do more of it. But a lot of it is volunteer work, so I mean, I do quite a bit of it. It's hard to make it like a full-time profession, though.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, for
obvious reasons.
Yeah,
not to mention just the time it takes to put into one project to get to the point of actually doing anything. Yeah,
but it's a great student project. Like, I've referred students to do things like this all the time.
That's so cool. And what was the third one?
So my third project was in my third year, kind of between clinics, and I worked with one of our professors who worked at the diagnostic lab at Cornell, and she is from Gambia. And so our project was actually in Liberia in Western Africa to introduce the poultry trade to them. So they actually import all their agriculture there, and they don't raise anything on their own. And so we were trying to basically, you know, there was interest in how do we raise chickens and maybe become a little bit more sustainable. Yeah, it's wild. Like, they were importing chicken from India and other parts of Africa, and chickens are relatively easy from an agricultural standpoint. And the professor I was working with is a poultry specialist. So that was a fun project. It was basically teaching a bunch of men only how to raise chickens, about diseases in chickens, because you can give them chickens, but if you don't teach them how to care for them or recognize when things are going wrong, that's what I don't support, is, you know, sort of this idea that, hey, I can give you this thing and it'll make your life better as a white Westerner, and then not give you any of the tools or resources to actually keep that going. And I think that does happen a lot.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, in a lot of scenarios. Yeah. Wow. Okay. I didn't see that coming. I love that you shared all that with us. Thank you. Because that, there's so much now. I mean, I know you, and so much of that just like makes sense. Like, oh yeah, okay, because that is a lot of travel early, but like with a specific focus. And so now I can understand like the connecting the dots for kind of the rest of it. It seems easier to me now, because I'm like, how did she do this? Like, how does she just find these programs? And like, this is what I want to ask you, is how is it that you do it now? But I kind of also want to back up a little bit, because this was the beginning. Well, correct me if I'm wrong. You had your family travel, but this was really the beginning of like Chelsea's international adventures, right?
Yeah. And I kind of went in like head first, like living in Uganda by myself when I was 23 for 3 months. There were a lot of challenges, like a lot of mental challenges and some physical challenges, but I mean, it was amazing. But yeah, I mean, as you know, you don't do a trip like that and come back entirely the same person. Like, so much growth that happens. And so, I mean, I kind of crave that, you know, getting outside of your comfort zone and just like having to make it work and figuring it out, like loving that you're figuring it out.
Yeah. Oh, I can so relate. You can't go back. I mean, once you put, once you, the word just came to me in Spanish, apply yourself. I think it's the word in English. Like once you apply yourself in a situation like that, where you are everything, getting breakfast is an adventure. I mean, just everything that you normally take for granted, like you have to figure out everything else. There's a dialect, you're a minority, like fill in the blank. You, there is no coming back from that. Like you can only go forward and you can only continue to then it's, I feel the same way. It's like a craving, but it's like, these muscles, like muscles in a body that you're exercising and like, you got to keep exercising those muscles. Otherwise they atrophy, you know? And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
Therefore we just continue to seek experiences that do that to us.
Yeah.
So what did that turn into for you?
So after I graduated, I had those like amazing experiences in vet school. And then I got a job, of course, and I was doing small animal general practice in Connecticut, where I grew up. It was a great job, great mentorship. You have to build your skills. So, you know, I can go in as like a student and be under somebody, but the whole idea is like now I'm a professional and I'm going to be that top person. So understandably, I didn't do a lot of international veterinary work in my first couple years of school or of my job. Mm-hmm. I still traveled for fun, but you know, it's a balance too. Like I love what I do and I love the international veterinary work, but also if I'm working all the time and I got 2 weeks of vacation, I was maybe not going to also then work during my vacation.
Yeah, I totally get that. Yeah.
Yeah. So It took a couple years of like really building my kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? My base, I guess, like my knowledge base, my skill base, confidence, you know, being able to find the resources if I didn't have them. I guess that to that point, when I'm overseas volunteering, I might not have resources. Like I might have the internet to look things up and, you know, we have resources online, but I might not. And I'm not going to travel with textbooks probably. So, you know, sometimes the resources are more limited. So I always encourage like younger veterinarians and students to seek out these opportunities. But I do think that you need like a certain amount of skill set before you go in, because you need to go in and be an asset to them. Like unless it is a learning program, you certainly don't want to go in and then be a burden or be unable to do what they're expecting you to do.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I was an associate for about 6 years. And I did a little bit of volunteer work during that time. I did a couple spay neuter projects. But I didn't do anything that was like an extended period of time. And as you know, when you're going to these places, like 10 days is usually not really enough. It's not enough to be helpful. It's really not enough to like get to Asia or get to Africa and come back and, you know, feel like you did anything. Mm-hmm. So at the end of my 6 years, I kind of burnt out. I had two jobs in that time, one in Connecticut for the first 3 years. And then I moved to New York City and I worked for another 3 years. And the New York job was great, but it totally burned me out. And so I had decided to take a sabbatical at the end of that. I wanted to do more international work. I wanted to volunteer. I wanted to be less pressured with kind of the downsides of working in a high-paced city, you know, high maintenance owners, very high level of expectation, boundaries that weren't really healthy from a work standpoint. Mm-hmm. So yeah, at the end of, it was October of 2019, and I took what was supposed to be 10 months off, but ended up being about 6 months because of COVID. And that's where I did a bulk of international work. So I went to the Cook Islands, which are off the coast of New Zealand. They're in the Pacific. And I worked there for a couple weeks. I went to Papua New Guinea and I worked there for a couple of weeks. I went to India for a month and did volunteer work. I went to Sri Lanka for a month and did volunteer work. And then I traveled with my husband, Andy, for a couple weeks. And then I was supposed to go and teach in Australia. And that's kind of when everything happened with COVID. So ended up coming back a little bit early.
We'll come right back to that. But first, let's thank the brands that support our show. Oboz Footwear is the maker of my feet's number one favorite adventure shoe, the Sawtooth X Low. I know that footwear is as personal and particular as our own feet, but if my feet could talk, they'd scream at you to go try a pair of these on, because slipping them on is like taking my feet to a cloud massage instead of a 15-mile hike. I don't make the rules, I'm just here for the ride. Aside from comfort and performance, one of my favorite things about Oboe's footwear is their commitment to sustainability. Not only are they a certified B Corp, but every pair of footwear sold helps plant trees across the world. Check them out for yourself and find out more at oboesfootwear.com/lovehiking. Osprey has been my go-to luggage for everything since 2015. My new favorite item to add to my list of trusty travel luggage is the Transporter Rolling Duffel 40 that I recently took as a carry-on all over Europe for 6 weeks on 13 flights, including a few of those budget airlines with strict rules, and it fit in the overhead bin on all of them. No lost luggage worries here. And with its high chassis, it held up beautifully on the cobblestone streets of France, dirt, rocks, ferries, and van transfers in the fjords of Norway, and even sandy surfaces on the coasts of Greece and Albania. 80% of Osprey's entire product line are certified Blue Sign products, and 100% are backed by their almighty guarantee. They will repair or replace any product for the life of the product. We are proud to support each other both on and off the podcast, and you can find out more at osprey.com. And thank you, wherever you are, for listening to the show and supporting these brands that help make it possible.
I want to know more about these programs, like what you did when you were working, but how do you even set this up? Because you just mentioned a bunch of places that are not necessarily close. I mean, maybe within a hemisphere, but how do you even begin to know that you're going to be the right person for this, to approach this clinic? How is it that you do it?
Great question. I mean, a couple different factors, I think, kind of start my thought process. One is I want it to be a place that I want to go.
Okay. Excellent answer. Yeah.
I mean, if I'm being honest, like part of it is like, oh, I'd love to go to this place. Like, is there a program that I could reach out to where I could do, where I could help them? And then, I mean, a lot of Googling of finding programs. Some have been word of mouth references or recommendations from colleagues. Others, it's truly been like veterinary work in Sri Lanka or like NGOs, nonprofits doing animal work in India or something similar. And then once I have a couple different places, I will look into them a little bit more and make sure that they are what they say they are. I've not had very many negative experiences, but I mean, some rescues are like hoarding situations, or like there's not really, they have no resources. And so it's really difficult to do anything there. Or, you know, thankfully I haven't, again, I vet these like pretty thoroughly, but I have heard of programs that are like not really ethical, or, you know, it's more of a mask for like animal tourism versus actually helping the animals. So there is a lot of research that goes into that.
Yeah.
And then I'll contact them. And, you know, some people get back to you and some don't. And so that kind of weeds down your options. But most of the time they have a vet that they work with already, hopefully who's local. And, you know, usually they're really excited. They're like, yeah, like I would love to have you come out here. One personal criteria that I have is I don't mind paying for housing and food, of course, but I don't want to pay to volunteer, which many of these are paid programs. There are a couple exceptions, like if there's a fee that covers your housing or you know, things that you need to be doing, totally fine. But I'm not paying to get experience. Like I am the professional now. So if I'm going to volunteer my time, like that's a big one for me. And a lot of them, unfortunately, are paid, which I get. Like it's two sides of the coin. Like they usually have very few resources and they are getting students who like just want to get experience. But I try not to do those personally.
So I'm figuring this out as you're saying this, because I do not know the world of veterinary medicine. Like I don't follow this world at all. So what the program is actually the right word, because I wasn't even sure I was using the right word, because it almost appears that you're just going in and working with, you know, veterinary clinics. So okay, that's fine.
Sometimes.
But like,
yeah.
But sometimes it's also a program similar, not not asimilar to what you did in your vet school work. Like something that has a purpose, that's an ongoing program. There's structure on the ground for it. And then they work with local vets just like you did in your vet school program, right? So it's a mix of both.
Yeah, a good example of that would be it's a wildlife rehabilitation center that I worked with a couple years ago in South Africa. And I mean, they are a rehabilitation center, so they don't have like on staff veterinarians. They work with local vets, but they are almost entirely dependent on volunteers. So like those are programs that advertise for people to get experience working hands on with animals. It is mostly students, gap year, you know, college students. Some people who are like semi-retired and this is what they want to spend their time doing, but they like definitely rely on that. They have like a couple full-time staff members and then really they rely on volunteers.
Wow. That's just amazing. So what kind of, tell us a bit about these experiences that you've had. Like, do you have any that just stand out as super memorable? And like, why were they? What animals did you get to work with? Like, what have you seen? What have you done?
Oh man, how much time do we have?
Yeah, I know.
let's see. I'll pick a couple like really standout ones. Every experience I've had has made me grow in certain ways and has been amazing. But if I had to pick like a location that was just an awesome place to work, the staff was great, the animals were fun, and it was like a cool place to live, I probably would put Sri Lanka up on top of the list. I mean, it was just like ideal. I would go to the beach in the morning. I would take my tuk-tuk ride to work. I would spend all day working on these dogs because it's an animal sanctuary with a local veterinarian. Cool cases because you see things there that you don't see elsewhere. And I mean, that's true for many of the countries that I've worked in. So it was like mentally stimulating. I felt like I was really making a difference. And then the food was great. And then I would go back and like stay at the housing that they had for us with other volunteers and a bunch of dogs that were living there and do it all again. And it was like, I don't know, it just felt like I was really having an impact in a very micro way, in a place that also was creating this quality of life that was really like good. So that one definitely stands out. In terms of like animals, my first summer in Uganda was great. I was working mostly with dogs, but because there aren't many veterinarians and because who I was working with, Dr. David, he was like very well connected. He would get called in to do kind of like miscellaneous wildlife work. So one story is that there was a chimpanzee that actually got caught in a trap, like wild chimpanzee. I mean, think of like the bear trap, right? Like huge, like iron trap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are hunting, right? Like for subsistence. So they're in the woods. And so somebody called it in and we went and we spent like all afternoon basically hiking in the jungle trying to find this chimp who is still running around and swinging through the trees, even though she had like what was a 40-pound trap on her fingers. Like it was only on her fingers. And didn't find her. We found her that afternoon, but we couldn't get to her. And so we all like kind of like hiked out, slept, got up super early because they bed at night, which you probably don't know, but chimpanzees will like make a bed in a tree at night and then they'll come down. So our whole point was to try and get her before she came out of her nest. And so we found her, darted her, caught her as she fell out of the tree, removed the trap, had to clean her wounds. We did take some blood samples to kind of also use it for educational purposes, kind of see if she was carrying any diseases or anything, and then let her wake up. And that was that. Like you have to kind of minimally interfere if you even decide to interfere. But because this was like a man-made issue, like it wasn't that she got mauled by some predator. I mean, that was just like the pinnacle application of wildlife work for me. Like that's the dream, right? Like that's what people want to do. You're like directly going in and helping this animal. So that one, that was just an amazing experience. Let's see. And then probably one of my favorite animals is the pangolin. which I know you've heard me talk about.
Yes, I know. I knew you were going to talk about this.
I know. I just love them so much. So the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in South Africa that I worked with a couple years ago, 2 years ago now at this point, they rehab pangolins that have been poached and trafficked and are emaciated as a result, like if they get caught. Electric fence wounds, so that's a common way that they get injured. They do get predated on, but not as frequently that we would find those necessarily. So I got to work directly with them, which was like a dream animal to work with. And I've stayed involved with them. So every year, like my company, me, donates a certain amount towards wildlife conservation. And so I donate to them every year. I brought down a bunch of supplies for them. I'm hoping at some point I get to go back down there. But yeah, they're amazing creatures.
Wow. Is that the most exotic, maybe, do you think, that you've worked with?
They're probably like the weirdest animal I've worked with.
Okay. Yeah. Because they're all scaled and
There's just nothing like them. And they're the most trafficked animal in the world. So they're unfortunately like very targeted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, in the U.S., you're a small animal veterinarian. So you normally work with
Dogs and cats,
right.
Occasionally some local wildlife, but not frequently.
Okay. List off some animals that you've seen, just that you've worked with, because you just brought up a chimp and a pangolin. So, like, what else?
We worked with a lion when I was in South Africa, or when I was in Uganda that first summer. Water buffalo, big in Indonesia, so we did a ton of work with water buffalo. Let's see, tree kangaroos when I was in PNG in Papua New Guinea. Some domestic livestock, right, like pigs and cows and sheep and goats and things like that. But yeah, from an exotic standpoint, I'm guessing that pangolin is probably the most exotic.
Yeah. What a neat story. Wow. I bet you feel really, like, what does it feel like to be able to just go and make a difference in a place like such a small village like that? Like, how does that make you feel? I bet you sleep well at night, like with that kind of career.
Yeah, I'm very grateful to be able to do it. I mean, I have to say that, like, sometimes I wonder how much of an impact it is making. I mean, I know that I can directly impact like this one animal in this one moment, but I mean, there is this kind of argument that I have in my head of how much I'm helping when I'm coming in for like just a short period of time. And, you know, I sort of wonder if there are more sustainable ways to do that. And of course, like training local veterinarians and doing that so that they're not reliant on volunteers coming in is definitely like the end goal. You almost want to not have to come in to volunteer, right? Because that means that they're able to do it themselves.
Yeah.
But yes,
and
I mean, it is
frequently. Yeah.
Yeah. It is very gratifying to be able to help animals that you know wouldn't get that help otherwise. And there is a flip side to that. You know, in those areas, we kind of touched on briefly, like what your resources might be. There are many times where I know I could treat this if I was in the U.S. and I can't treat it because I'm not in the U.S. or I'm not in a place that has XYZ to treat this thing. And in the Cook Islands, that was a big deal because they see a lot of hit by car dogs there, the stray dogs. But because of the environment, because of the humidity, because of the heat, because they're often strays and there's like no follow-up, like fixing fractures doesn't happen. Like, you know, broken bones. But dogs do great on three legs, and so there you do a lot of amputations down there. But, you know, it'd be like a broken leg that here you would do pins and plates and it would be fine and it would have a perfectly functional leg. And down there you just can't do that. So, you know, there are differences in working in those places.
Sure. I bet it's
and
hard.
Challenges.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sometimes hard. Diabetes. Oof. Here we treat diabetes all the time. You're not treating diabetes in most of these island, you know, meet potentially more impoverished areas where maybe people don't even get treated for diabetes. And you have a stray dog who's a diabetic. It doesn't happen often in strays, though, because it truly is like mostly a disease of overweight animals because it's type 2 diabetes. But, you know, those would be other things that you just aren't treating for there. It's just not manageable.
Yeah. I bet that's hard because the part of you that just wants to save them all, you know, probably battles a lot. But
yeah, but also recognizing, and I think this comes just with like maturity within the profession and the more that you see, is recognizing when, if that's not possible, then, you know, here we are at this point where actually we can end suffering, which of course is its own topic of conversation. But yeah, I mean, I think just being able to sit with that and be like, nope, this is an acceptable option in this case, and recognizing that.
Yeah. How often do you bring supplies with you? Do you always bring?
I try to bring them always. Yeah. I mean, not so much like surgical instruments that I'm personally using, although I have done that if I know that they don't have certain things. But I always try to maximize what I'm bringing for them, like how I can most benefit them. So for instance, when I went to the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in South Africa, for the pangolins, they use I actually have a bottle of this. It's not the right kind, but it's like a recovery food for animals. It's a liquid. And they exclusively use this for the pangolins when they're rehabilitating them before they can start eating again, because they eat ants and termites. And so I basically called the company, the food company, and I told them what I was going to do and asked if they would donate. And so I brought down a couple cases of that for them.
Amazing.
And usually I'll like reach out to all the distributing companies and be like, I'm going to do this thing. Like, do you have any expiring bandage material? Do you have any of this? Like, fill as many suitcases as I can bring down for them. Sometimes it doesn't make sense to bring certain things. Like, it's actually less expensive for them to buy them in country. But for certain things, you're actually really being helpful by bringing it.
I love this. I mean, listening to you talk about this, it's just neat when, you know, we're all different. We all have our different passions, and that's so for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a reason that you have the interest that you do and the motivation, the overachieverness that you have, so that you would actually not just go and do a program, but contact this company and that company and that company and fill all these suitcases on the way. Like it's a production, what you've created just around yourself and your passions. And I think it's amazing. What do you think you've learned, like, how do you apply what you've learned by doing all of this with your international work to your vet work back home? Because I know it looks different. Like, you don't have, well, maybe you should explain a little bit how you work here in this country, because it is different than I think most of us would consider. I didn't know that relief vet work was even a thing until I met you. And so maybe you can explain that a little bit, but also like, how do you apply all of these world experiences that you've gathered from around the globe just in your kind of everyday work here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I try to revisit that, right? Like obviously these are places where I'm trying to merge my passion for travel with my passion for veterinary medicine. But I'm trying to not do it selfishly. Like, selfishly, I want to see this place, but I also want to have a positive impact there. And like, also how can I bring that back to my own practice? So I do relief work now. So I was a full-time associate for 6 years, same practice in those two different jobs. And now what I do is I fill in to hospitals that are understaffed or have somebody on vacation or maternity leave, and basically just come in and hit the ground running for them. And so I do that full-time. So I'm still working full-time, but I just work in about 15 different hospitals throughout the year instead of one.
In lots of different places too.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm based in Bozeman. And so I do work all over the state of Montana. I work in Salt Lake City in Utah. I also go back east so that I can also see my family. So I work in New York, Boston, and Connecticut. And then I have also worked in Florida as well. So yeah, I have my fingers in a lot of places. But the upside to that is that it does allow me to make my own schedule. So while I do work full time, I'm perfectly content working like 12 to 14 days in a row, but then taking a week off versus having like a 3 to 4 day, 5 day work week, you know, in repetition. So that has given me the opportunity to travel a little bit more, where I can take off 3 weeks and maybe do that twice in a year, where I wouldn't be able to do that otherwise. All that to say that, I mean, I think actually my volunteer work kind of prepared me for the relief work in a way, because you have to be able to adapt to each hospital that you're in, and you're only you're a good relief vet if you can truly hit the ground running there and be able to practice in a way that is not trying to change what they're doing, where you can meet their clientele where they are. And there's a whole spectrum of what that looks like. Like working in small towns in Montana looks very different than working in a fast-paced hospital in New York City. And so I do think that my experiences have allowed me to kind of see the whole picture. And I don't have just one way of doing things. Like I have to be able to do them multiple ways. Different medications. This practice doesn't carry it. This one does. Like you have to kind of know what your options are. So I do think it allows me to think a little bit more broadly. And then the other thing, kind of going back to meeting clientele where they are from a practice standpoint, is that resources are different everywhere. And so I think part of what makes a good veterinarian in the U.S. is somebody who can look, who can say, look, plan A is here and it's going to be more expensive to do this. But plan B, C, D, E, and F are all options. And like, what do you want to do? And so being able to kind of formulate those medical plans in a way where you're just meeting people where they are financially, ethically, you know, whatever they want to do in a way that is still not doing any harm and is hopefully treating their pet. I think that's my goal always.
It makes so much sense when you lay it out that way. I mean, all of the experience that you've had just being applied to that, it's like the perfect path for you, especially since you crave that adventure of having different things all the time.
Yeah, I love doing relief work and being in different places. But one of the hospitals I work in, just as an example, like the medical director there, he was like, I could never do that. Like, I would just never do that. Like, I like coming into my hospital and doing and knowing that everything's the way it is. And I do enjoy that, of course, but I mean, I kind of thrive on the newness, right? Like I like the challenge of it. I like knowing that that I'm good at it, not to sound like conceited about it, but I do think that like I have this skill set and I've built these blocks that have allowed me to go into a brand new hospital that I've never worked in before and be able to make it work, like not have it me be frustrated by it or have people be frustrated working with me, that we can kind of just arrive at like, here we are, like this is what we're going to do.
Yeah. Super adaptable, flexible, and obviously professional. Like you just know what you're doing now. That's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, now it's been 11 years since I've graduated. So I think I can finally say like, yeah, I think I know what I'm doing. And not to say like every single day in veterinary medicine is like, like you just learn things all the time, like a case that you've never seen before or a circumstance you've never been in, or, you know, it's just, I love that it keeps you on your toes. And I think this would be true in medicine, period, but things change rapidly, new information. And so I do love that about it.
Yeah. Do you have your sights set on any other programs at the moment? Like, is there anywhere else that you'd really like to go and volunteer?
Yeah, I really want to try to get back to Africa. And so I would love to go back to Southern Africa so I could work with pangolins again. That would be a goal. I haven't like directly worked with some of the bigger South African animals like elephants and rhinos, which I think would be neat. From a medical standpoint, like I have been around them, but that would be cool. Specific program. This is like just switching gears a little bit. There's a program to help the animals in Ukraine that I'm interested in going to, but probably not at this exact moment.
Yeah.
Like it feels a little too risky to go there right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I gotta be smart too.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Wow. Oh my gosh. Okay. So we're going to wrap up here, but I want to two more quick things. One, if you have just one piece of advice for maybe there's somebody out there who is a vet or is going to vet school or is like, wait, what? Like this is available to me. What kind of advice would you give to that person? Or even let's say maybe somebody else like in the volunteer space who is maybe not skilled in veterinary medicine, but would be interested in these programs. Like, what kind of advice would you give that person?
So I think probably I would say, like, do your research, like know what you're getting into, because there's nothing more frustrating than like having an expectation and then being disappointed by that. So having an open mind about it as well. And then just going in knowing that these people are trying to help the animals, if it's an animal program, or, you know, maybe it's working with children in town in a village somewhere. Like, everybody's there for the same reason. So try and, like, learn as much from each other as possible. But, you know, you just have to show up and do your best every day.
I love that. And choose a place that you want to be.
And choose a place that you want to go to and see if you can be helpful. Like, see if you can be a mule and just bring down a bunch of bags of things they need.
Mm-hmm. What a neat way of combining your skills and your passions. And, no, I think it's such a cool groove, just like a little niche, you know, travel experience that you've created for yourself. And I appreciate you sharing everything about it. So the last question's really easy. You have like one of my favorite Instagram handles ever where you share your work. So will you share that with us in case anybody wants to follow you?
Sure. I'm not as active on it these days, but it's a good reminder that I should be more active on it. But Eat, Spay, Love, at Eat, Spay, Love is where I share a lot of my vet stories. I just figured that people didn't always want to see graphic images of animals on my personal Instagram account.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Okay. Well, Eat, Spay, Love, if you guys want to find and follow Chelsea there. Anything else you want to add to this or...
No, this has been great. I mean, it's always a fun reminder when I start to talk about these things and it feels like I'm a little like bop, bop, bop all over the globe. And then it's like, cool, I also did all those things. So, and I'm always happy to be a resource. I mean, there is a lot of legwork involved and, you know, things I've learned and things I've learned not to do. And so if anybody is interested, I mean, absolutely, like, I'll probably leave my email in the show notes. And yeah, I'm always happy to guide people for that.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, yeah, again, good luck on with all of these programs going forward. I mean, I know that it sounds to me like from the person on the outside, it sounds like you're just making a massive difference. And I love it. It's super inspiring. So I know that like being the person in the saddle is different because you're the one doing the work. And sometimes you don't stop to like pat yourself on the back and recognize what you've done and what the impact that you've had. And even just by sharing your story, you're having an impact on people. So
thanks, Jackie.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Okay. We'll catch you next time, but appreciate you very much. And, yeah, best of luck to you.
Thank you.